This is Not the Average Real Estate Podcast by Not Your Average Real Estate Investor. Dipna Boholt used real estate investing strategies to completely replace the income from her accountancy practice with passive income in just 18 months and has since taught thousands of others to do the same. Welcome to the I Love Real Estate Podcast.
Welcome back to the I Love Real Estate Podcast. This is John Gian filling in here for Dipna Boholt, who we're giving her a little bit of a break from official duties as she has been focusing on two things. First of all her current members coaching and mentoring students. And the other thing she's really been heavily focused on for the last 4 to 5 weeks is delivering the Conquer the Chaos live virtual summit. Yes, she's been doing them live and developing that content out. And you've been listening to, by and large, a lot of that content in this Conquer the Chaos virtual summit replay series that we've been dropping here in the podcast. So I hope you've been enjoying it. We're up to part 7, and here in part 7, Dipna brings it home. She brings it home from the point of view of making some bold future predictions. I certainly don't want to be betting against her. And with the fullness of knowing how she got the 2008 and 10 GFC absolutely spot on, I think you're going to be really fascinated into what she's going to do to lay down here and plan out. You know, it's great to give content, but you've got to have the conviction of actually delivering a future result and having conviction in your content to actually back it. Because it's very easy for people to say, you know, it's the end of real estate and it's doomsday. And, you know, we've had all sorts of people come to this country and talk about 30% and up to 50%, you know, crashing of real estate. Then you'll be very, you know, very heartened to hear what Dipna has to say with the fullness of everything she's covered in Conquer the Chaos up to this point. So without further ado, I know you're keen to get on with it. So let's get on with it and let's shoot it straight across the Dipna and cover, you know, exactly how to play this real estate cycle out and this, you know, economic climate out in the next 6, 12 and 24 months. Enjoy this episode. I know you will.
So what are the elephants in the room? Well, the elephants in the room are inflation, unemployment and immigration. So these are the things that I want to cover because they're typically the things that come up when I'm going, yeah, but what about inflation? What about unemployment? What about immigration? Our borders are closed. Doesn't that create the growth? Okay, let's deal with it. Let's deal with all these three because these are the three majors that are an objection generally to what I've just covered there. Now, look, that's not my strategies. That cyclical stuff is not my strategy, but I tell you what, it fits perfectly in line with my fundamental analysis. I'm a fundamentalist, but you put those two things together, I'm telling you, it's really a very strong argument for what action you should be taking right now. Okay, let's talk inflation. Now, there's a paradigm shift in economics right now. The old school of thought is that money printing causes inflation always. Does it? It actually doesn't. And you look at the periods of printing money, particularly this is a US chart there, it doesn't cause inflation at all. So the new paradigm of thought is called the modern monetary theory, MMT. And it says this. Printing money, or money printing, causes inflation, but only in sectors where capacity is constrained. So, where have we got constrained capacity? It's not in production, because if that were the case, we would have CPI increases, but that's not going to be the case. It's not in production. Where it's constrained is in asset markets. Therefore, asset prices will inflate. Share market prices, house prices. And you can see that in GFC. This is what happened in the GFC period of time. Asset prices went up, including stocks and shares as well as real estate, but the real economy did not. The cost of a banana or an orange didn't go up. The cost of a chair and a table didn't go up. So CPI didn't go up. But shares and property went up. Interesting, that's a US chart. So these constrained markets, the biggest constrained markets is land, because they're simply not making any more land. Now, let me ask you a question. How much land do you control if you own an apartment? Nothing. How much land do you control if you own a townhouse? Very little. How much land do you control if you own a commercial building on a freehold title or a residential property on a freehold title? Particularly if it's got room to do other things on it. A lot more. It's land, that land content that will appreciate in value. Cost of buildings will go up because we'll have material costs go up and a few things like that, but they won't go up as much as the land desirability will. And that's what's going to force property prices to go up. So let's move on to unemployment. You know, we are going to have increases in unemployment. It's going up every month. Will it continue to go up once we get past the cushion period of JobKeeper and JobSeeker? I actually feel you're going to see the unemployment rates come down. Once we get the dole back to the $250 a week or whatever it was, then a lot of people who are not prepared to go and do any job right now, and I know that's not the case for everybody, and I'm really sorry if you've lost your job, and I'm not accusing you of anything, but there's a lot of people that are happy to sit on Job Seeker at $550 a week that will not be prepared to sit on the dole at $200 a week, that will do other jobs. They will do menial jobs. They'll do jobs that just pay a wage, as opposed to jobs that, you know, you're sitting on the dole. So I actually think once the once we get past the job seeker and the job keeper, I actually feel it might take a couple of months of leveling, but we're going to start to see it come back, particularly if during this time the states unlock us, get us out of our houses, get that economy going again. Some states are doing a better job of this than others. Victoria at the moment seems to be the worst. Queensland's a little bit behind the eight ball, particularly with its borders and other things, but we're starting to see more and more people. We're starting to see 50 people starting to get back into restaurants in New South Wales and those sorts of things. So as we release those restrictions, and I think there needs to be a little bit of a public outcry on some of that stuff to get it happening a little bit quicker in some of the states. You know, when there's elections coming up, state elections, etc., they need to be more conscious of whether they're going to get in next time as to how quickly they get that economy back going again. So I don't think it's going to be anywhere near the 15%, which is the worst case scenario. We might crack for a short time 10%, but I think it'll come back down pretty quickly as well, as that V starts to happen. Because all of this, that predictions there, was done pre-JobKeeper. So pre-JobKeeper, yeah, it might have got that high. I don't think it will with JobKeeper in place. This just shows you, compared to last year, how many new jobs are being listed. There's still a few being listed, but nowhere near what it normally is for the month of April through into May. Again, without JobKeeper. Now let's move on to immigration. Now this is pre-COVID, and we saw there how the immigration was tracking along, and you know, we basically had somewhere around the just under 400,000 new people coming into Australia. Great. How did they disperse? Most of them went to Sydney and Melbourne, and you can say New South Wales and Victoria, but you can count the regional areas. They didn't go to Dubbo, they didn't go to Walgett, they didn't go to Moree. They went to Sydney and Melbourne. Okay, so they're the places that are experiencing the greatest growth because of that migration intake. And you can see there the other states and the percentage of people coming in from overseas and the impact that it actually makes on a migration basis. This chart here actually shows the top 25 states from councils from a migration perspective. I was actually shocked to see the figure there in Brisbane City Council. But when I analysed, I thought, yeah, fair enough, because there's a lot of universities and those sorts of things in and around the city in that Brisbane City Council. And the Brisbane City Council is huge. It is a very, very big council. It takes up most of Brisbane. Whereas when you look at Sydney and Melbourne, the rest of those councils are Sydney and Melbourne. You know, the other states don't actually get a look in other than the Gold Coast. The rest are all Sydney and Melbourne suburbs. So that's where the most of the migrants are actually going to. So will migration fall greatly as a result of coronavirus? Look, it will in the short term because we've got our borders closed. But will it last? I don't think it will. Migration has been the major contributing factor to our growth in the past, ever since we've had colonisation of this country. So short term, over the next 12 months to 24 months, immigration numbers are likely to fall. I think we'll start to open the borders next year. I actually don't think we'll get an immigration increase this year. I think it'll be next year, but I think it'll be early in next year. This will be partly due to limitations on international travel and overseas student intakes. I mean, the university is going to kick up such an outcry if we don't have new intake of students next year. So for the beginning of the year next year. However, once these restrictions are lifted, and they will be, it is reasonable that the recently high levels of overseas migration will resume. In fact, I believe net levels of overseas migration to Australia will rise, not go down. And this is likely to continue for several years as the government endeavours to expand the economy to pay for COVID stimulus. We need these migrants. You know, we are underpopulated in this country. Sure, there needs to be some incentives so they get out in some of the rural areas as well. Otherwise, Sydney and Melbourne are just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. But when you look at the stats, the median age of an overseas migrant in Australia is 26 years old, whilst the number for the Australian citizen is 40 years. That's our median age. 61% of overseas arrivals to Australia are currently aged between 18 and 34. Australia will need their tax dollars in order to pay for and recover from our current COVID deficit. Interstate migration is also likely to return to similar levels to the before COVID outbreak. There's no reason to see why it wouldn't. Migration is historically quick to respond. Construction, slower to respond. Hence the lag effect, hence upward pressure on housing. So you get a migrant in this country, they've got to live somewhere immediately. And within weeks, they are in the rental pool. And within a year or two, they are in the housing pool of some description. So it's an immediate impact. It immediately puts that upward pressure on housing. But for us, we can't produce houses that quickly. We simply can't. We're already in undersupply, as I spoke about this morning. So the immigration, we are going to need their tax dollars. They are skilled coming in. They are young. They are baby breeding ages. They are household, occupying ages. They are taxpayers. It's that the Australian government would be absolutely crazy if they didn't increase the quotas for migrants into this country as we come out of COVID. That's what's going to happen. That, along with infrastructure spending, is what will be the biggest flow-on effect into the economy, which will create the biggest rebound through to that 2026 period of time. Oh, I pressed the wrong one. This is a great chart here, and it actually shows growth, unemployment, and inflation. Now, it's been put out by the Reserve Bank of Australia, but it was done as a survey of economists, okay? So it's probably a little bit biased. 2020, growth's going to come down. Yep, it will. But it'll rebound just as quickly into the next year. Unemployment is expected to go up, but not expected to reach 10%, and then come down substantially to 2021 and down further from there. Inflation is expected to fall through the floor, but not go into deflation before it starts to come up again. And they're actually really low levels. I mean, we were below 2% inflation going into COVID. So an ideal level of inflation for a country of our size is around about 3%. That is ideal to have a nice steady level of growth. I think it will be a couple of years before we get to that kind of level of inflation. So, you know, the chatter is it's the worst data since GFC. What you should be hearing is it's the best opportunity since GFC. That's what those words translate to. You need a translating dictionary. When you hear stuff like that, you should be getting excited about what that actually means. Let's have a look at another chart. I know I'm filling you with charts today, but I'm just so off on this stuff. I'm just really excited about what they mean. So if we go back to 2004 through to 2012, that's how the chart went. Let's just pull that part of the chart out. And we look at these periods of time. Now you can see the peak there in that 2008 period of time. Peaked in 2008, bottomed out 2010, and then we had it starting to go up. All right. That increase was roughly 5% per annum increase if you average it out, including a downward drop of negative 5 during that downward drop after the 2008. Then we got that massive increase. It was 20% up to that period of time. So when we see, so what are the certainties? The market will overcorrect as it did back here. Market overcorrected and then it went going again. So we're going to see that again. That will happen. Then we're going to see the market rebound. And as that market rebounds, we need to look at what happens next in the charts through GFC through to 2020. So same chart. There's our downward bit through 2008. There is our upward run and our stabilization period of time. And then we have the massive run up again through to 2018, because it was premature, our dropping off there at the end of 2017, because of APRA. And we can see we nearly came back to it again before COVID struck. That is a 70% increase from the bottom of the market. Now, so if you bought a house at the bottom of the market in the previous cycle of 500,000, your property at the 2000 and just before COVID would be $850,000. So will it overcorrect? Yeah. Will it rebound? Yes. The stimulus will also have an effect. And this is the thing, when you have a look at the stimulus and what's happened there, you can see that the Australian stimulus, when you compare it to the other countries, is significant. It's absolutely significant. And that's going to cushion everything that happens. You know, across the world, we saw $2.7 trillion in just 6 weeks. That's a lot of money. So it's the best opportunity since GFC. Might be the worst data, but that translates to the best opportunity since GFC. Clearance rates. That's actually not a very good chart. I want to show you this next one that I just put into. No, I didn't put in. Maybe I didn't put in. The clearance rates that I showed you this morning, you start to see there's more and more houses being cleared, 70-odd% in Sydney in clearance rates. Sure, they dropped off when the whole thing was announced and we went into shutdown. But now they've rebounded, and they've rebounded significantly, a lot more than people expected, me included. You know, you start to see that chart again as to where unemployment might go. I don't think it's going to go anywhere near that. What's copter hiding is consumer confidence. And this is, you can put the blame fairly and squarely here in the hands of the media. You know, the massive, massive reaction for months. We've heard nothing else. You know, I don't know whether they're still fighting in the Middle East. I don't know whether, you know, what the soya bean market is in the US. I don't know a lot of stuff because it's simply not being reported unless you go looking for it. So a lot of the commercial television particularly is just run on fear. It is crazy. And that is why people's heads are in the wrong spot. Now they should be getting excited. But it'll turn. It'll turn. The GFC happened more slowly. I think the lack of confidence in this time round is mainly due to a health issue as well. Like, you know, is grandma still going to be alive? Am I going to get the coronavirus? Am I going to survive? Is it going to hurt? So there's a lot more health-related lack of confidence that's making it worse this time than GFC when it was all just about money. But it rebounded. You know, it rebounded very, very quickly. It has every single time, and it will again. Just like it has every single time, you know, after last, over the number of years. So it is the best opportunity in history. Let's take that further and we'll start to have a look at how, if the GFC repeats itself in the projections through to 2026 in a different format. I'm just going to show you charts this time. So that was our chart that we saw before. But let's now look at what is likely to happen in that next run-up. And that's just putting it on that same trajectory. That means that this time we're going to have a downward shift, we're going to have an upward run, bit of a correction, and then we run again. Overall, we're looking at around about a 70% increase, which is what's happened in the past if we fall that much. If we fall 15%, that's what it's likely to be, and we could. I don't think we will because of the cushioning effect. I think it'll be, you know, maybe even sub 10, but in some places anyway, and then we're going to see that rebound. So when we start to have a look at that property clock, what does the property clock mean for you? And what action do you need to take right now? So I'm just going to unshare and I want to go back to, so I can see you all and bring up the chat room. Just give me a bit of an indication in the chat room. What are you feeling since we've covered that kind of stuff? What's your general demeanor? What's your attitude to what I've covered so far? Pretty good. Positive cash flow. A few questions there about lending. Will lending continue? And, you know, the banks are still lending now. I tell you what I'll do to help you out. How about tomorrow at 12 o'clock? I bring on one of my strategists to talk about lending in particular and what's happening, what are the trends from a lending perspective. So, you know, I know they're lending, but you know, I want you to hear it from somebody else. Why don't I say, let's do another Q&A tomorrow at say 12 o'clock and I'll bring my lending guy on to answer a lot of those lending questions for you. Because I'm just going through your comments now, and it's right across the other, you know, complete markets. And you're right, not all renters are born the same either. You know, some are better than others. Long term, yeah, generally you're getting pretty excited about it. So. Yeah, there are some redundancies, I get that. But when you look at it as a percentage of the overall population, it's less than 7%. So you may be seeing that because you happen to be in that industry, but it's less than 7% across the board. Okay, pretty positive across the board. All right, so let's go back to sharing my screen again. Thank you for those comments. Thank you for the interaction. I like this quote by Bill Gates. He says this, "If you're born poor, it's not your fault. But if you die poor, it's your fault." And that's the thing. We have an opportunity right now. We have a little bit of grace time to be able to really put things in place so that we are ready. But then it's going to rebound fairly substantially. And I think that's something that we do need to be ready for. It took me 6 months. You don't have 6 months. To get market ready and to get yourself ready for what's to come. You know, most people go to work, they're inside, they're outside, they've got kids, no kids. Most people want something else. They either want more leisure time, they want more travel time, they want the dream house that comes along with the dream mortgage. But most people don't get there, and here's why. You see, we go to work, we save some money. We go and buy our first home, typically our own home that we live in. Now, I'm not opposed to that, but what I'm opposed to is the type of property that people buy and who they buy it from. You see, most people go and buy a property that is what I call a developer's profit. So there's nothing you can make on that property other than waiting for the market to move. Now, you can't control the market. So consequently, you know, you have no control over your outcome. And these properties, you know, they're exactly the same as everybody else's in the suburb or in the high rise, upstairs, downstairs. There's no differentiation between your property and anybody else's. The Gold Coast is the best example of this. They go and build whole housing estates, exactly the same. Same colour, roof slants this way, one goes that way. They're all four-bedroom, two-bathroom, double lock-up garages. It's little wonder that the Gold Coast actually has the highest divorce rate of anywhere in Australia. You know why? Because they go, the poor buggers come home, they go through the wrong door and they sleep with the wrong wife. Because their door houses are all the same. So differentiation is important. But the other thing that's important is the fact of who you buy it from. You see, most of these properties are sold through marketeers. They're sold through marketeers through their database. You know, you get that phone call. I can save you so much on your tax. I've got a property, da-da-da. Cold calling. Well, they're the kind of ones that are overpriced, $40,000 to $80,000. You don't want to be in that market. I'm not opposed to you buying your home, but buy a home that's going to make you more money than the market. You have to buy a deal, not just a place to live. And don't buy something that overextends you, because along with the McMansion comes the McMortgage. So make sure that you always have those buffer zones in place, that you don't overextend, that you have split facilities in place, and that you have that strategic plan even on your own home. And eventually, even if you buy it through the marketeers, time goes by and that thing goes up in value. The same marketeers who sold you the first one go, oh, have I got a deal for you? There's this thing called negative gearing. It's the best thing since sliced bread. Make the government pay for your property. Negative gearing. For every dollar that it costs you, all you're saving is 30 cents. So you're burning 70 cents in every dollar. It's a mug's game. You go and, you know, time goes by, buy it through marketeers. Even that one goes up in value eventually. You go and buy another one, you burn some more money, and ultimately you end up like this guy in retirement. And I'm going to place him as Amber. It's on that Amber line behind me. Because that's where most people go. That's what they ends up happening. You know, when we start to have a look at the dynamics, most people, in fact, 88% of people over the last 40-odd years have got it wrong. And I'll show that to you in a moment. But while we're on this, I want to show you the bell curve. Now, the bell curve is a fundamental of economics. The bell curve is the median standard deviation, basically, the median distribution of any market, whether it's properties or whether it is any market that you choose to have a look at. So I want to just share this with you on the screen. So this is the bell on the board. I mean, this is the bell curve for property investors. Okay, you know, the bell curve and all sorts of things. This is how it works for property investors. So here's my bell curve. There's my line. Okay, so this is property investors. All right. Now, typically at the bottom end down here, we have 10%. Now, that 10% of the market say that they are property investors. They're looking for properties, all the rest. They might own one property, but they're really not achieving. And these are the guys that are totally uneducated. These are the guys that will never be educated. They won't step up. They won't put their money where their mouth is. You know, these are the guys that'll whinge at the market. It'll be everybody else's fault. There'll be lots of blame going on here. Then you have the biggest section of the market. And it looks like this. 78% of the market, typically. And these are the guys that give it a go. They give it a crack, but they really don't get ahead. They don't achieve their goals. They might get one or two properties, but again, they're uneducated. They might have gone to a couple of seminars. They might have gone to a few introductory things, but they haven't been prepared to work to a strategic plan to achieve a goal. They're like the social sport player on the weekend. They have a bit of fun, they make a bit of ground, they get a bit of fitness, all the rest of it, but they really don't power ahead. And that's 78% of the market for property investors. Then you have the next category out here, which is another 10%. So these guys have stepped up. They are paying for their education. These guys are making a difference. They're starting to achieve some goals. They are educated. They've still got a way to go. They're on track, but they're not quite there yet. And then you've got the last percentage over here, which typically at any one time represents about 2% who are actually living the dream. The dark green guys, they're the ones, they're living the dream. They have achieved their goal. They're like Dee on that recording that I had on stage with her. You know, she trips around the world. She does volunteer work around the world. She travels anywhere she wants to go. She's retired. She doesn't have to work anymore. She can live off a passive income and, you know, look after her grandkids and do whatever else she wants to do. That's the ideal for most people. But that ideal could happen at 35 just as easily as it could at 65 if you put these things into place. And that is that standard deviation, the standard bell curve for property investors. Now, just before I leave this, because I'm going to show you some statistics, notice that this section here represents, can you still see that on my screen? Yeah, 88%. And this section here represents 12%. Okay, got that in mind? All right, so let me take you back to my slides. Bring my thing down and I'll start sharing again. Okay, so as I drew on the board there, you can see there, let's have a look at these stats now. Did you know 88% of those people who turned 65 last year, 88% are on a pension of some sort, part or full pension? Only 12% are actually self-funded retirees. 88% of people have got it wrong for the last 40 years. 88% have either been not educated or following the wrong strategies for the last 40 odd years to end up on a part or a full pension. A lot of that is due to negative gearing, but most of it is due to complacency and compliance and lack of information. Only 12% actually get out here to being self-funded retirees, and that's shocking. Most people are not prepared to invest in themselves because, you know, you can't lose that in a divorce. Your knowledge and the investment that you make in you, you can't lose in a lawsuit or divorce or anything else. And it's so important that you take that step. Otherwise, you end up in the 80% on the pension. And how much is the pension? It's not much. You know, for a single person, it's $22,000 a year. And for a married couple, it's $33,000 a year. That's not a lot to live on. At the moment, we have 5.3 taxpayers for every pensioner. And if we don't change things, we're going to end up with 2.3 taxpayers for every pensioner. We can't afford that, which is another reason why immigration is going to increase in the next few years and continue to do so. So we talk about self-funded retirees. Now, you know, we are living longer generally. We have better medication and things like that. So our statistics are changing when it comes to retirement. For those who own their own home, the average value is around $500,000. For people age 65 and over, two-thirds have a weekly income of only $400 a week or less. One in four retirees receives close to a full pension, and a further quarter receive a part pension. We have the poorest pensioners, second poorest pensioners in the Western world. Only South Korea has poorer pensioners than us. Isn't that awful? It's shocking. It's a blight on our economy. You know, and we see the ads on TV about the retirees and this happy couple with their dog skipping along the beach. That's not how it is. For a lot of people, it's like this. You know, they don't eat for a week because they had to pay the electricity bill. Roughly one in four retirees, let me just bring that up again, I've got the wrong slide here. Roughly one in four seniors aged 65 and over are either renting or still paying off their mortgage. The proportion of people aged 65 and over with no superannuation at all is around 65%. And the median superannuation balance as at 2017, I know this figure's a little bit old, but still the same, it's shocking, $100,000 for men and $28,000 for women. And the proportion of all Australians with superannuation balance of over 500,000 is just 5%. And the thing is, we're living longer. So not only are we, well, we've got the second poorest pensioners in the world and we've been doing it wrong for 40 years, we're living longer on no money. So we're poorer for longer. If you were born in the 1900s, the expectation when you were born is that you would go to school until you were 14, you'd be dead by 51, you'd have no retirement, and 73% of your life would be in the workforce. If you were born in the 1950s, the expectation was that you'd go to school until you were 14, you'd be dead by 66, you'd have 6 years in retirement, and 69% of your life would be in the workforce. If you're born in 1975, the expectation was that you'd go to school until you were 17, you'd be dead by 69, you'd have 9 years in retirement, and 62% of your life would be in the workforce. If you're born in the year 2000, the expectation is you'll go to school until you're 22-ish. You know, you'll be dead past 80 somewhere. We don't even know where yet. You'll have greater than 20 years in retirement and less than 50% of your life will be in the workforce. So, you know, there's a lot of change happening and we need to take stock. We need to take control of our positions. I'll show you a project here. That's all very interesting about the retirees and how they did it wrong and whatever. But what it actually creates for us is a niche as property investors to provide affordable accommodation for that age group that got it wrong, living on the pension, can't afford to own their own home and need to rent in retirement. This is a project that really shows that. Now, this is one of my students' deals. It's a construction deal. It's a development. And the uplift in value on this particular development is somewhere between $380,000 and $400,000 in value. It's not a specific over 50s or any of those kind of over 60s village, but she only rents to those people in the over 65 bracket. Over 60s, I think is what she's decided to do. Some of them have care accommodation as well, and they are smaller. It's a gated community. So, you know, they don't exactly have rave parties on Friday nights. They feel safe. It's on the outskirts of Melbourne. It's still a Melbourne suburb. And it brings in $31,000 of passive income a year for her. So not only did she make money out of building it, but it's $31,000 a year positive cash flow. Now, how many of you want one of them? How many of you want 10 of them? You know, and this is the thing, it just makes such a massive difference in your life. When you look at the this is 2018, the figures for superannuation, etc., it's not a lot. You start to have a look at self-funded retirees, self-managed superannuation funds, the numbers are still small in comparison to what they should be to sustain us. Nothing happens until the pain of remaining the same outweighs the pain of change. I like that quote. Because most people won't act until they have a trigger, until something happens in their life and it hurts, before they actually are forced to make a change. We are not good with change. But if you don't change, nothing's going to change. You know, you'll be on the same path, the same trajectory. You're going to be sitting around doing the same things in a year's time, 2 years' time, 5 years' time. You actually have to do something different in order to get a different result. You have to make better decisions to get a better result. You have to know more in order to make better decisions to get a better result. It's simple. Education is the key. Education is the catalyst for change. You know, I have an excuse-free zone in my household. I don't believe in excuses. And you can come up with all sorts of excuses. But the thing is, the people that come up with excuses, if you're sitting there at the moment and you've got in your head, oh, I can't do this because, you know, or no, this isn't for me because, oh, yeah, but I'm different because, oh, but. If that's what's coming up for you right now, I really, really want you to look within, because it's got nothing to do with the course. It's got nothing to do with the affordability. It's got nothing to do with how much time you do or don't have. It's got nothing to do with whether you've got money or anything else. What it's got to do with is something much, much deeper in you. There will be an insecurity where you need to deal with that. Otherwise, it becomes a habit and it will infiltrate every part of your life, not just here today, but in every facet of your life, in your work, in your career, in your relationships. It just keeps showing up and showing up and showing up. And whenever you have a repeat pattern, it's never them. It's always you. It's always you. There are things that you need to do for you. There are some personal growth things that we need to get through. There's some self-sabotage that's going on that you need to be able to overcome in order to be the best version of you, to get the best results as you possibly can. So, you know, whether you think you haven't got any money, too bad. You know, a man without education is like building without foundations. Education is the thing that creates value. You put into applied education and you get profits. If you're sitting there with not a cracker to your name, you know, I've made it as affordable as I can. Two cups of coffee a day and you're in front. Once you start the education and you start to have a look at what you can do with it, you learn grid variance analysis. That's your first task. You learn the trainings and the learning at the boot camp. You learn feasibility studies. You start to use your coaches and your strategists. Then you can start to do things like find deals for other people. The going rate in my community tends to be around $10,000 to $15,000. You package a deal up that works. There's plenty of people out there that, you know, would happily take the deal on and pay you a spotter's fee for doing it. Joint ventures with other students. If the deal's good enough, you'll find somebody to do that deal with you. Option flips, where the outlay is very minimal. It's all about the workload. Things like vendor financing. There's going to be a lot more of that stuff coming up shortly. Seller JVs. You don't need money to be doing that. You just need the smarts. Income uplifts. There's lots of things that you can do. So money can't be your excuse. Time can't be your excuse. Everybody's got time. Everyone's got 2.5 hours a week. Most people have got 30 hours a week to do something with that they're currently spending, you know, 34 days a year on social media. How much time do you waste on social media? How much time do you spend playing games? How much time do you spend watching Netflix and TV and stuff? All of that time can be reallocated to serve you better. This is actually a quote by Albert Einstein. He says, if you want something you've never had, you have to do something you've never done. Doing the same thing over and over again is the definition of insanity. I replace my income on 2.5 hours a week. We all make time for what we feel is important in our lives. This just needs to become important. It needs to become important to you and your career and your future. And if you can't spare 2.5 hours a week, you're delusional. You're not trying. I did it on 2.5 hours a week and I was a busy solo mum running my own accountancy practice. Everyone can put in and find 2.5 hours a week. Fear is the thing that kills dreams. Fear kills more dreams than failure ever did. It always makes me smile when I see that, what if, what if, what if, what if? It's hiding fear. And fear is coming from a lack of education and a lack of self-confidence. A lack of knowledge to know what's possible. a lack of knowledge to be able to make decisions based on sound information with confidence instead of running to fear. And I see it. I see it in the chat rooms. I see it, you know, I see it out there in the general public. And I can see it here today. There's many of you that are acting in fear. There's many of you that won't make the decision to actually invest in yourself because you're in fear. And while ever you're in fear, you won't move ahead. You won't get the kind of results that you want to get because fear puts you into freeze mode. Fear will hold you back. Thinking will not overcome fear, but action will. And I like this quote as well. The difference between who you are and who you want to be is what you do. So what are you going to do? Are you going to stay looking like this, as most of you indicated you were, or worse this morning? Or do you want to look like this? Because that's where you need to be. That's where you need to be putting things in place to be able to achieve the results that you want. That's where you get to that center point there with money for life, with passive income, growing portfolio, protected. You know, you're recession proof. Nothing can touch you. What are you going to do with your 30 hours that they say we have every week? Or are you going to act in fear? Are you going to go? Are you going to be part of this group? Are you going to be part of the red? Or are you actually going to step up and be part of the green and take this course of action? The worst scenario here is this drift. Making a habit of drift. You'll get some ups and downs if you take this path. This is not educated. This is the acceleration point to education, to achieve your goals, whatever they are.
So there you have it, bold predictions from somebody who not just talks about it, but really backs her convictions. And certainly with understanding the past, you have the ability to predict the future. And that, as you have probably gathered through the series, through this deep dive series, you know, hasn't been a 60-minute fluff session. It hasn't been a 60-minute opinion session. It's been, I think, up to part seven. We're well into 7 hours of content here. And you know what? We're not actually finished because we do have a bonus 8 session. I'll tell you about that very, very shortly. But you saw in this session clearly that even if the real estate market does come back, you know, it'll give us an incredible buying opportunity. And if you overlay that with what she covered in part 6 with the property clock, you can now get a picture and cycles and understand that we're potentially, right, going through this period. We're in this opportunity zone where we'll be able to pick incredible bargains going forward, and then we can ride the next wave up. As crazy as it may seem, as unlikely as it may seem from the mainstream media and how they're pitching the news and where unemployment is, you clearly see that we're going to continue this cycle going forward. Dipner laid it out beautifully. And those invested, those who will see through the negativity and actually not, you know, sell everything and run, but actually go the other way, which will be a small minority, will benefit greatly in this environment. So that's, I know you would have loved part 7. So here's the bonus. We're going to actually put another session on to the Conquer the Chaos Virtual Summit. And just one thing just before you go too, a lot of people have been asking, can we still attend live? Well, depending on when you're listening to this podcast, you may have an opportunity to attend live. So I suggest you go to iloverealestate.tv, and on the front page right there, if we're running any more live events, then you know you can book a free seat to the live event. And of course, experiencing this event live and spending 6-7 hours of your life, just going through, you know, from your own financial well-being is probably the best decision you'll ever make in the next, you know, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days going forward. It certainly will set you up in a big way in the future. So iloverealestate.tv, there may be an opportunity for you to experience it live. Now, part 8. We're going to be dropping part 8 soon. And part 8 is Dipner, at the end of the summit, what she decided to do was do a special Q&A the next day of the live, and this was also a live Q&A, which you will see for yourself, where she got participants to actually come back and ask questions, and she got her team, people like her finance strategist team, accountants, people talking about self-managed super fund. She answered a lot of questions. It was a lot of freestyle. Everything was on the table. Whatever people wanted to talk about, they could. She also followed up on questions from the previous day's event. So, you know, there was a lot of what ifs, and there was a lot of, you know, questions relating to people's circumstances, but you can actually, you'll enjoy that as well. So look out for part 8. That'll be the finale, and we'll bring it home with part 8. Guys, thanks for listening so far. Have a great day.